Something to pay very close attention to, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is my co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
As always, Barry, I'm glad to be with you back here in the studio, dealing with the issues that are at hand. Of course, we record this during the week for play on Saturday, so things could be very different, especially when we do current events, but we don't think so. We don't think they're going to be too much different this week.
Well, Chuck, we're into fall, and that means that not only is Congress doing what they're doing, which everybody knows about because we've all heard about the whole issue with the budget impasse and the government shutdown and debt ceiling increases and defaults and on ad infinitum ad nauseum. And really, nauseam is where I am with all of that.
I was going to say, nausea had long ago set in.
And the lack of leadership of a certain House Speaker and the total lack of leadership of anybody in the Senate to basically say that we're just going to spend more money and increase the debt ceiling by $1 trillion and move forward with Obamacare full bore. And we're only going to do this until January, and then we're going to fight this fight all over again. You know what? It makes me actually pleased that this week we don't have to focus on what's going on at the federal level because, honestly, nothing changes there.
Well, let's talk about this for a second. The fact is this whole mess was caused by the attempt to get Obamacare off the table.
Yes.
Now, if you'll recall, it started out with repeal Obamacare.
Yes, it
then
did.
Then all of a sudden it morphed.
To fix it. Fix Obamacare.
Fix the unfixable. This is sort of like trying to fix a Jabberwocky that's held together with baling wire and chewing gum and duct tape and all kinds of stuff. The fact is, what you need to do is just junk the whole thing and reinvent something new. Mm-hmm. Well, the fact is, what we need to do is not something new, but something old. But that's really not where we're going with the discussion, but it's been interesting to watch this thing more from we're not going any place until we get Obamacare repealed to Obamacare defunded and delayed by a year, and now we've got nothing.
Well, and actually they'd almost capitulated to, okay, we'll fund Obamacare, but we will renege on the waivers, but basically the subsidy. That's the word I'm looking for. The subsidy for Congress.
Yes.
And for congressional staff. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. $5,000 to $10,000 per person per year subsidy for your congressperson and their staffers to get health care under Obamacare. Now, do the individuals get that kind of subsidy? Only if they get into all the exchanges and they go with the government plan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Congress, I mean, that was the one of the few things that the House leadership was trying to bring to the table. Once they had capitulated on everything else, that was the one thing they were trying to bring to the table was, well, we'll renege on giving ourselves that subsidy. We'll take that off the table so we're like everybody else. Well, Chuck, we know they're not like everybody else because their health care plans and our health care plans are, you know, one of these things is decidedly different. One of these things is not quite the same.
Yes.
Well, we know where that is.
Well, yeah. And what's interesting about this, had the Republicans held out, all you got to do is read the opinion journals for the last, 10 days or so, because the bills are starting to come due for people's health care plans. And people are seeing doubling, tripling, 2.5 times, blah, 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 blah. And I'm not talking about merely conservatives who were out there commenting on this. I'm seeing stuff in Politico, in the Huffington Post, in the Daily Cause. There was an article that just ran the other day in the Daily Cause where somebody got their first health care bill. People are livid about this. They said this was supposed to be cheaper, and instead it's costing me money. Well, the bottom line here is the same bottom line as it always is. Somebody's got to pay for it. There aren't enough rich people to pay for it. You're going to have to take it out of the hide of the middle class. Where does it always come from? There's way more us than there are of the rich. So who gets the tax burden? We do.
We do, of course. Who else would get the tax burden?
Yeah.
It's just, but, you know, let's just use common sense, which I know is usually lacking when we're talking about our elected yeah. officials in Congress. But let's just use common sense. All of these things just mean more expense for you and I, the taxpayers, because businesses have to pass on their cost of doing business.
That's it.
That's just, folks, we don't live in a socialist utopia where the government then provides all the means of support, provides all the means of production, and provides all the means of resources either. You know, we surreptitiously live supposedly in a free market capitalist society, but we know that's a lie because our government keeps trying to push us more and more to that socialist model. Well, this is the big push right now. You when they can control your health care, and they can control your education, i.e. Common Core, which we've talked about over the last few weeks, there's not much left that they have to control in order to control the population. There's just one other item they have to control. Guns.
Guns, yeah.
That's it.
Well, and again, I read an article this last week, and unfortunately I didn't save it, but it basically says that the gun control advocates are beginning to go to the California model. Now, if you'll remember, you and I did a radio show earlier this year where we talked about what's happening in California. Is anyone who's ever had basically any kind of mental health treatment whatsoever, so if you get depressed and go to the doctor and take some counseling and maybe some Zoloft or something, suddenly you can't own a gun in California. Well, basically, here is the logic behind that. What they're saying is anyone who would want to own a gun is obviously mentally deficient.
Exactly. Has an issue to start with.
Has an issue to start with. And therefore, we need to get them in for an evaluation. And once you've been in for an evaluation, we're going to deny you the right to own a gun. It's a very clever strategy. And it could end up being successful if we aren't aware of it.
Chuck, now that we're talking about it, you know me, I like pulling out the old crystal ball. You know, it's black, it's got three holes in it.
Yeah.
My crystal ball. I'm going to make a prediction. I'm going to predict that probably not too far in the future, after all the quote-unquote bugs have been worked out of the Obamacare plan, and they've started actually enrolling people, that what will happen is another provision will kick in or be implemented somehow through regulation, not through legislation, that would say that in order to keep your subsidy, you have to surrender your firearms.
Oh, I think that's in the offing. I don't see any other way around it other than that. That is absolutely going to happen.
Yes, because it's a health and safety issue, Chuck. We have to keep the premiums down so you don't shoot yourself or shoot somebody else. Oh, of course. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you think that that's crazy, that's fine. Go ahead and send me an email or a text at principledpolicy.com and tell me I'm crazy. And then we'll wait here a few months and figure out if I'm actually insane or not, which, honestly, Chuck, I'm going to ask you, what's my batting average?
They don't. Let's put it this way. They don't want to be a pitcher on the mound against you.
Well, God has given us the ability to discern. It's just that when it comes to politics, I think that I can actually start putting pieces together because, as you know, Chuck, and you and I both do, we find all of these various pieces. We're not afraid to go look at what the liberals are saying,
right,
what the conservatives are saying, what the moderates are saying. Matter of fact, one of my favorite aggregators on the web is called PollUrls, P-O-L-U-R-L-S, and it's an aggregator that you can pick your color. If you're into this color thing, if you want to be a red state guy and you want to just listen to conservative talk, you can pick the red channel. If you're a hardcore card-carrying leftist Obamaite and you love the color blue, there's the blue channel. And if you're a middle of the road or moderate, maybe squish, or you just don't know where you're going to land, they have the purple channel. Well, I've got the master one that puts all three of them up there at once, so you can look at the same story from 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 different views, facets. And usually when you can do that, you can start putting together pieces. That's the reason why when I make these quote-unquote predictions, I'm not a prophet or the son of a prophet. I'm just somebody who's looking at the times and seeing which way things are heading.
Right. And it's interesting what gets called conservatism on some of these blogs. You have to have we're getting into a mindset where you either walk in lockstep or you're some kind of a flaming liberal. I've come out and talked about major problems with some people's ideas, you know, and discussed them in a, I thought, in a rational manner and not in, in some kind of snarky way or anything. And the first thing that happens is, oh, you must be some kind of flaming liberal. Well, anybody that knows me knows that that's simply a laughable notion.
Well, okay, Chuck, that leads to another. We're going to get around to talking about some actual policy issues that are going on here in a little bit, ladies and gentlemen, so bear with us. But that really leads into something that has been on my mind and heart for a little while now. That is the tendency, even in Christian conservative circles, to have been conditioned to believe that one party or viewpoint is good, one yeah. party or viewpoint is evil, and that there isn't a tinge of the fact that we are fallen creatures in both viewpoints.
It's political Gnosticism.
Okay, that's a good way of putting it. And for our listeners who haven't been following us very long, explain what Gnosticism
okay.
is.
Okay, Gnosticism is a dualistic view. This is one part of Gnosticism, but it's probably the keystone on the pyramid. It is a view that there are things that are good and things that are evil, and there is no view of the general goodness or badness of all things that are created. So in other words, in a religious Gnosticism, there is a philosophy floating out there that the body is bad, but the spirit is good. This gives rise to a number of viewpoints, a number of religious viewpoints, which we're not going to go into. And the same thing goes on with religious Gnosticism. One thing is good, the other is bad. And there's no ameliorating idea or, you know, that, no, everything, man is the common denominator in all those things. And
yes.
and man's depravity is the common denominator. And if you just do the right things and just become more spiritual in the religious sense, then you will become more good. If you go with the body, you'll be more bad. Well, believe me, there's lots of poison you can put into your spirit.
And yes, there is.
And the same thing goes with religious Gnosticism. You know, all things conservative are not necessarily good, because all things conservative, really, the phrase has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. If Mitt Romney can be a conservative, and some people call me a conservative, we see almost nothing alike.
No, not even remotely.
And if John Boehner can be called a conservative and I can be called a conservative, then, again, the phrase has absolutely no meaning, because I see the limits to his power. He sees himself as having an unlimited power, and he will do whatever he wants to do, and too bad for anybody out there who doesn't like it. He's even talking about this thing will pass. We're recording this on Wednesday when the House is about ready to cave in on the Obamacare deal and on the shutdown deal. And he's basically quoted on the Drudge Report, and you know those things change every 10-15 minutes, but he's basically quoted on the Drudge Report as saying he will do it with or without the Republican Conservative Caucus. If he needs Democrats to get it done, he'll get it done. And he's got enough toadies. People like Representative Peter King. There have been a number of moderate GOPers who've come out from northeastern states and Minnesota and a number of other places who basically come out and say, yeah, we need to get things rolling again. We don't care about Obamacare. Let's get rolling. So that's what I mean by political Gnosticism. It's a dualistic approach to this problem rather than a holistic approach.
Yeah, well, and you're absolutely right on that. But that's the thing that always concerns me, Charles, because, you know, as you talked about going and having these discussions, and whether it's Facebook or Twitter or email or even talking to people, ultimately, when you push up against cherished fantasies and myths,
yes,
the results, the responses are visceral and predictable. that people are, it's just like the other day when we were teaching class at IOTC, we talked about the fact that the founders did not provide for a standing army. And you would have thought we were saying that anybody wearing the uniform of the United States is a traitor to their country. Right. With some of the reactions that we got, because
yeah.
people have been conditioned to believe, well, the PR, you know, the whole army of one, blah, 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 be all you can be, et cetera. But our founders' initial idea was that a standing army was a step down the road to tyranny. Because if you got someone in with the power of the executive who had a standing army at his disposal as commander-in-chief, that he could very easily turn that army against the citizenry.
Well, that was the exact argument.
Yeah, that was the exact argument.
And in fact, that's why so many of the states wanted to retain their sovereignty, was because they understood what happens when you get a standing army. And in fact, that's why the Constitution only allows a two-year requisition
exactly,
for funding.
Exactly. You can only fund an army for a period of 2 years, and an army can only be called up by Congress.
I think you could successfully argue that a small standing army is not necessarily a bad thing and is something to be desired. An officer corps.
Well, that's called a militia, and it should be at state level, not federal level.
Yeah. You usually need an officer corps so that you've got a corps of people around who the militias can gather. But still, the Constitution is very clear. The leadership and the command structure of the militia comes down from the state.
Come from the state level.
Not from the standing army.
Or at least it did until, what was it, 1913?
1909.
Okay, yeah, that's right. 1913 were some other things that happened.
Yeah.
But 1909 with the Dick Act,
yeah.
which basically all but federalized all the leadership of the
right.
Guard. And created the National Guard.
Yes, so. There was no such thing as the National Guard before 1909.
But those are the type of things, and I'm just using that as an example, of when you start talking about this real history, people don't know this real history. They don't understand that our founders didn't want standing full-time professional armies or military of any sort except a Navy.
That's
and
right.
The only reason a Navy was allowed to stand was because of protecting commercial shipping from the United States, protecting our ships. You know, we're looking into this time period as you move from the late 1700s into the early 1800s, and what did you have going on? We had the Napoleonic Wars.
Yes, that's right.
If anybody's ever seen the movie Master and Commander, hello, that's the reason why we have a Navy, was to keep from having privateers and others who fly flags of foreign nations basically commandeering our ships for capturing whatever, you know, the commerce that's on them, materiel, or impressing men into the service of their war.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically the War of 1812, hello.
Yes.
Now, anyone who's actually studied the War of 1812 knows that the impressment of American sailors was a major issue, but it wasn't the major issue. We won't go into that, but one of the things that they were using it as an excuse to invade Canada.
Yes.
Because they wanted to bring Canada into the Union. And the Canadians were, shall we say, reluctant?
I think that would be fair.
Yes, the Canadians have an independent spirit, and of course they were a dominion of Britain at the time, but how do you govern something the size of Canada from Britain? The Canadians basically were more or less autonomous. So and they didn't want to be part of the United States. They wanted to maintain their relationship with Britain, and a lot of American loyalists ended up going to Canada. Well, that's fine. So the War of 1812 was fought partly over that issue of American impressment of sailors. So, yeah, that's why a Navy was maintained, but an Army was done on a two-year requisition program.
Yes. But those are some of the things that I'm very concerned about, especially in our current environment, Charles, because many people take what they hear uncritically because they don't have a lens of historical analysis or theological foundation in many instances in order to be able to discern truth from error. That's the reason why we're fighting a fight right now over the call for a constitutional convention in Ohio, because many people have been given a very jaundiced view of history.
Let's talk about that just for a second.
Well,
we're
rolling into that because we're going to be talking about the number of issues that are happening at the state. Because, the federal stuff, ladies and gentlemen, we can fight that all day long. But the point is, the battle was lost when the House capitulated earlier this week.
Okay. I'm looking at an article right now, and I will save that for later.
That's good.
I'm looking at an article right now that basically says Republicans shut down the government for nothing. And here's the, here's what it says. With a deal to reopen the government apparently imminent Wednesday, it's worth taking stock of what it was all for. The 2.5 weeks without a fully functioning federal government, well, big deal. No, who felt anything other than people who work for the federal government? Nobody. But anyway, the nonstop chaos on Capitol Hill, the tiptoeing to the brink of default, Molly Ball writes, for Republicans, here's a quote, for Republicans, it was basically for nothing. The GOP will actually get less out of the final deal being brokered than the party would have gotten had House conservatives never staged their revolt on Obamacare. In fact, the drama is likely to end with Republicans ceding policy concessions to the Democrats. I would say that that is a direct hit on the bullseye.
I think it is, too. Absolutely.
There is absolutely...
Whose article is that from?
That is on this, I got it from this Paul Earls.
Okay, Paul Earls. Okay, good.
But
I thought it
sounded
familiar.
And it's in the moderate. It's in the mid-range. In the purple range.
Yes. That's P-O-L-U-R-L-S for any of you who are out there who would like to look at this. I've actually had people who've asked me, you know what, I'd really like to find out, how do you guys figure this stuff out? And I always point them over to that aggregator because, like, you have to be willing to look at more than Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck.
Yeah.
You have to be willing. It won't cost you your sanity or your soul to go look at what moderates and liberals are saying about the issue and then try to figure out, okay, we've got these three different voices or multiple different voices. What are they all saying the same? Because that's where the truth lies, Chuck.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It's when they inadvertently are all saying the same points.
Well, we called that up 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
When we ran that thing on Jerry Brown.
Right.
And we pointed out the fact that they get it on nullification. The state of California, the far left, gets it on nullification. And honestly, right now, the Republican quote-unquote conservative caucus does not get it. And guys like Mark Levin, who we normally like a lot, doesn't get it.
And really doesn't get it.
And a whole bunch of so-called conservatives don't get it.
You're right.
Because nullification is the only power that they have to apply, get their 10th Amendment state sovereignty back.
Mm-hmm. Well, but Chuck, honestly, I other than what's going to end up probably having to be just a overt action at some point in the future on the part of many states. And I actually heard a member of the legislature today, and I'm not going to say who, openly talk about the idea that if it keeps getting worse, there may have to be some talk of secession, which is amazing considering that this is coming from a member of the General Assembly.
Considering the fact that we can't even get him to look at a 10th Amendment sovereignty and nullification.
Yeah.
This wasn't even nullification.
Right.
It was simply a resolution declaring their sovereignty
through
the 10th Amendment.
I know. But, you know, the point is, though, Chuck, and you know what my maxim is. I've said it on this program before. You've heard it dozens of times. My maxim is the left always outrun their cover.
Yes.
And it's absolutely consistent. Right now, the big problem is, though, Charles, is that people are having to be shaken out of their preconceived notions that when I say left, I mean Democrat. Now
right.
We're starting to see the leftists
coming
out of the Republican Party.
And that's that political Gnosticism that I was...
That's exactly.
Left does not mean Democrat.
It does not. And I'm going to give you the reason why. And this ties neatly in with everything we've been talking about so far, ladies and gentlemen. And it also, this ties in intimately with Obamacare. Because the reason why we hope you're listening today is we want you to get active and make some phone calls. There are some people that you need to be calling, and you need to call them first thing Monday morning. Okay? Now, I'm not kidding. First thing Monday morning. Get up, brush your teeth, make your bed, say your prayers, do your Bible devotional, put breakfast on, pick up your phone. That's what I'm talking about. Because on Monday morning, on October the 21st, the governor of the state of Ohio has directed his director of Medicaid, John McCarthy, to bring a request before the state controlling board. Now, Chuck, I know right now the first question is, what's a controlling board? Because the vast majority of people don't have the first idea of the labyrinthine levels and layers of our state government. The controlling board is a board that is within the Office of Management and Budget. Okay? It is populated by three House members, three Senate members, a director and a deputy director. And the director, it comes from the Office of Management and Budget. They are responsible for authorizing the expenditure of state or federal dollars to specific programs. When the money is appropriated by the state legislature and the budget, then each agency or institution, which includes the universities, the state-supported universities and others, go and make a request to the controlling board to release certain amounts of money to them for the purposes of X, Y, and Z. You know, and it could be as small as, well, I'm looking right here, the attorney general asking for $60,000 to renew a contract on credit card services for the collection enforcement section. So when they go after people for back taxes and not paying their taxes, they've got a place where they can, you know, pay by credit card. But that costs $60,000, you know, and they're just asking for a renewal, okay? Many of the agencies do this. Well, the one that's going to be on the hot seat on Monday is a request from the Ohio Office of Medicaid. Did you realize we had a cabinet-level agency now called the Ohio Office of Medicaid?
Yeah, it's not shocking.
We do indeed. Now, let me just read you the shorthand from the controlling board. Now, in a minute, I'm going to tell you who's on the controlling board, so hold tight on this. Make sure you get a pen and a paper ready so you can write all this down. But the Ohio Department of Medicaid respectfully, and I'm reading it directly from the controlling board's website, respectfully requests controlling board approval to increase appropriation authority in fund 3F00, ALI 65163. You don't care. It doesn't matter. Okay. They just all have these like code names. So you know which fund you're talking about. Medicaid service dash federal. In other words, federal money. By, and remember, this is to increase appropriation authority. In other words, this is to give them more money to spend. Okay. By $561,700,000 in state fiscal year 2014, which began July 1 and will end on June 30th. That's our fiscal years run July to June, not unlike the feds, which start in October and run till September. Why they can't go January to December, I don't know, but it's the way it is. And to increase appropriation authority in state fiscal year 2015, which would be next July, by the amount of $1 billion, that's billion with a B, $999,500,000. Okay? Everybody got that now? We got that. We know where we are. Well, that sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it?
Well, if you figure there's about 6 million taxpayers in Ohio.
Yep.
$600 million sounds like $100 a piece.
Yeah. Yeah, but the point is, remember, this is federal money.
Yeah, well, okay. Who pays federal money?
Federal money? That's exactly. We just went back to you. Who pays? The taxpayer.
That's
pays.
Right.
We're getting it from California taxpayers, right? So,
yeah.
Chuck, remember I said an increase in the appropriation.
Right.
That was the key word, increase. This is Medicaid expansion, ladies and gentlemen. This is the thing they've been fighting on all year long, that the governor has been out there saying that if you don't support it, then God's going to strike you dead. I'm roughly paraphrasing, yeah, but he said something close to that.
Yes.
This is how much they're currently spending federal on Medicaid. For state fiscal year 2014, it's $2.966 billion. And they want another half billion on top to raise it to $3.528 billion. For fiscal year 15, the appropriation is $3.196 trillion. They want to go up by $1.999 billion, in order to make the appropriation for fiscal year 15 $5,196,000,000 in pocket change. And I wish I had that pocket change. It's over $300,000.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having that.
That pocket change I'd be okay with. Now, what they say this is for, Charles, and they're honest about it, because you have to be when you go to the controlling board, you have to explain to them exactly what you're doing. This says this appropriation would provide Medicaid coverage to adults without dependent children between 0% and 138% of the federal poverty level. Okay? And parents otherwise not covered by current Medicaid eligibility levels up to 138% federal poverty level. These individuals are enumerated in the Department of Medicaid State Plan Amendment on Eligibility as approved by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on October the 10th, 2013. John Kasich's administration, yeah, went to Kathleen Sebelius and the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services and did the thing that they said they weren't going to do. They applied for state waiver and money.
Yep. The exact thing that they were, they absolutely, Kasich ran on that, as
ran
I recall.
Ran against doing that.
Yeah.
I believe clearly in violation, because how intimately tied this is to the expansion of Obamacare. Now, if you want to know how this all ties together, ladies and gentlemen, this week, the Senate version of the budget impasse fix, the temporary fix for the debt ceiling, et cetera, was moved. Okay? The debt ceiling increase that is temporary, supposedly, but let's say temporarily, it's permanently temporary, was $1 trillion. Okay? In order to fund the expansion of Medicaid to the states, which is what John Kasich is asking for, to the full extent that that the Obama administration said the states were eligible for, each state was eligible for, is the comes to the tune of $6.3 trillion in additional debt service. We don't have that money, Chuck. They would have to increase our borrowing capability by $6.3 trillion. And you know what? When we first started down this road, before they shut, quote unquote, shut the government down or slimmed it down, whichever one of those phrases you like to use.
Yeah.
The original Senate offer was just for a permanent debt ceiling increase of $6.3 trillion. What a surprise.
There's a shock.
And so now they had to pare it down to $1 trillion in order to get this fix done and to push something through. Well, originally, Ohio's part of the pot would have been somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $13 billion of more money coming from the feds. Well, right now, they're only asking for 2.5. Huh. Is 2.5 one-sixth of 12? Or not?
Close.
It's within shaving distance, yeah. Okay? It's within shaving distance. This is what's happening. They knew where the Senate was going to land at. They've changed their appropriation. They're going to appropriate the debt ceiling increase, and then they're going to flush all this money to the states to get them to lock into Medicaid. And John Kasich is leading the charge in Ohio. This is not a conservative. This is not a small government. This is not a fiscally responsible thing to do.
Not even close.
Now, right now, as you and as I mentioned in this controlling board request, and I pulled it up, folks, and I'll send this stuff to Chuck, and we can put it online. If you're that big of a policy wonk and you want to actually read it, that's fine. But the key is that they've already said it's for anybody who's without dependent children. Okay, so they're just raising the eligibility. Doesn't matter. Okay, right now we cover people up to 100% of the federal poverty level, right?
Yeah.
Now we're saying 138%. We've just increased our caseload 38%. Okay? Then we said with dependent children who are otherwise not covered by current Medicaid eligibility. In other words, there are other pots of money that they're already getting for Medicaid, but we're going to go ahead and push it so that we can cover those folks at 138%. Now, the children already get, if they get into the SCHIP program, they can be covered up to 200% of federal poverty level.
Okay, just for fun.
Yes.
Family of five.
Yep.
133% of federal poverty level.
Yes.
$36,668 a year.
Right. Okay, and so you basically that extra 5% would get them to about $35,000 a year.
Yeah. Well, no, it's actually higher. It would go up to 37,38,000. Because 150% is 41,355.
Yep. So what we got, ladies and gentlemen, is a governor who's decided that since he couldn't get a bill passed in the General Assembly to do this, he's just going to go ahead and do it anyway because his friends at the federal level have said, yeah, just go ahead and do it. The money will be there. Now, that raises a slight problem, Charles. The problem is called a constitution.
Why bring up such a tiny impediment?
Well, because I'm not the one who brought it up. Okay? Today, on the floor of the Ohio House of Representatives, There was an action that was taken. A number of Republican members of that body, 38 of them to be exact, has filed a protest letter against Kasich's attempt to unilaterally now expand Medicaid in Ohio. And basically what they've said, and I have the copy of the letter right here, that says, we, the undersigned members of the Ohio House of Representatives, hereby protest the filing of a controlling board request by the Director of Medicaid, John McCarthy, seeking to appropriate additional funds specifically not appropriated in the prevailing Appropriation Act of the 130th General Assembly, amended Substitute House Bill 59, or what we call the budget bill. Chuck, that those other numbers that I told you, the current existing numbers, that was what the General Assembly said that they could spend. Now, it's interesting because the other part of House Bill 59 that was in there that the governor line item vetoed was a prohibition against the administration seeking additional Medicaid funds.
Of course.
Okay?
Of course.
Now, here's what they say, and this is the letter continuing. Specifically, the request seeks to expand Medicaid by making a, quote, appropriation that would provide Medicaid coverage to adults without dependency. Well, this is what we read already. Quote, unquote. It says, however, the request does not carry out the clear intent of the General Assembly as indicated in its passage of amended sub-House Bill 59 and should be denied. Now, here's where the constitutional crisis comes into play, Charles. The legislature put language in the budget to say you can't do this. The governor has line item veto authority in a budget, and he vetoed that out. Now he's going to the controlling board and saying, I don't need you.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, now the governor, through the line item veto power, has been given the authority to legislate.
To legislate. That's not what the House members who wrote this letter believe, because they go back to statute. And they say, pursuant to Ohio Revised Code Section 127.17, quote, the controlling board shall take no action which does not carry out the legislative intent of the General Assembly regarding program goals and levels of support of state agencies as expressed in the prevailing appropriation acts of the General Assembly. Okay, sounds good, right? Only key problem with that is their intent was vetoed by the governor. So now we have a constitutional crisis.
Yes, we do.
And we have a significant one broiling here. They actually quoted a case out of the Ohio Supreme Court, said that basically that the Supreme Court applied that section of the code to declare a nullity, in other words, it of no effect, an action by the controlling board that was contrary to the clear intent of the General Assembly. Now, I weigh with you. Yes, the General Assembly was clear in their intent. But when the governor vetoed their intent, the question remains, does he have the authority to veto intent language?
Oh, boy.
We are running into some seriously choppy constitutional waters.
Majorly
now.
Choppy.
However, believe you me, if the governor and his director of Medicaid and his director of the Office of Budget Management move forward and approve this on Monday, and it looks like he has the votes, and I will tell you in a minute who you need to call in order to try to squirrel that. Basically, he will have said, the legislature can pass what they want to. I'm not going to be bound by it. And folks, if that's not the definition of tyranny, I don't know.
That is the hallmark of a tyrant.
And I'm not calling John Kasich a tyrant, but I'm saying he's treading into some very dangerous waters with the way he's wanting to push his agenda forward. As a matter of fact, it kind of reminds you, as Kevin O'Brien said in The Plain Dealer today, it seems almost presidential, but not in a good way.
Yeah, that's right. I was hoping you would bring up that quote because we talked about it off air. It looks presidential, but not in a good way.
That's right. Now, the Republican members in this letter also said, and I'll go farther because I'm not going to go into all this, these minutiae.
Right.
But at the end, it said the Ohio Constitution grants legislative authority solely to the Ohio General Assembly, an authority which cannot be delegated. That's where they're making their stand, right there. This request is thinly veiled legislation creating new eligibility levels and funding levels for Medicaid. In fact, the request itself admits as such. Our protest is not about the merits or lack of merit in expanding Medicaid. Our protest goes to the fundamental form of government upon which our country was founded, a republic of checks and balances and separation of powers.
Yep.
The General Assembly is a co-equal branch of government that made its intent abundantly clear. The controlling board request attempts to subvert that intent and is contrary to the Ohio Constitution and current statutory law. For all these reasons, we protest the filing of the above-described controlling board request. Chuck, I'm pulling out my black three-hole crystal ball again. If they approve this request on Monday, I believe it'll be before Friday that some group or numerous groups will be filing a federal lawsuit.
There will be a suit.
There will be a federal lawsuit over this, a state-level one and probably a federal-level one. I can almost guarantee, and right here is the structure of it. This letter.
Oh, yeah.
This telegraphs
the language of the argument.
Right. Now, this effort is being led by House Majority Floor Leader John Adams of Sydney. Now, John's a friend. He's also a friend of constitutional government and of liberty. He's going to get beat badly verbally by the governor and his minions over this.
Okay? And in the press.
In the press. And by his colleagues in the Senate. Just today, and I'm going to pull it up here because I just got it in right before we went on air, I received an update. I get a little email about what's going on in and around the State House that the Senate President, Keith Faber, basically said on Kasich's Medicaid move, quote, "I think he can do it," unquote. So the House is not getting much support from their colleagues in the Senate who ought to know better.
Well, they all want to be governor and sit in the seat and do the same thing.
Yeah. Now, basically what Senate President Keith Faber from Salina was talking about was he thinks the governor's got the votes on the controlling board. Well, you know what? He's right. He does sadly have the votes on the controlling board. And what he has is of the seven members of the controlling board who actually have a vote. Here's where it breaks down, okay? And we know this from looking at this. The president of the controlling board is of the Office of Budget Management, which means that he serves at the pleasure of the governor. So Randy Cole, he's the seventh member. He'll vote to break ties. He'll vote with the governor. Has to. Okay? We know right now that the Democrat members of the controlling board, which are Representative Chris Redfern, who's the state Democratic Party chairman and who's already publicly come out in the media saying Medicaid expansion is the foundational cornerstone of Obamacare.
Yes.
That he is supporting it. He's supporting this request. Senator Tom Sawyer, former congressman, who is a Democrat, is in favor of this. So there's three votes right there, Charles. He only needs four of seven, okay? the two Senate members are Senator Bill Coley from Butler County, who has, we've heard, is going to be a no vote on it. Okay? I would hope that that would be the case.
Yeah.
The other is Senator Chris Widener from the Greene County area. And Senator Widener, we understand, is most likely going to be vote with the governor and will provide the fourth vote. Now, that may change come Monday morning if enough people blast his office phones with, you can't vote for this Medicaid expansion. And we're gonna post up on our website, please go over there, this link with all their phone numbers. It has their office address and their phone numbers. Don't send them a letter. It's too late.
Yes.
Pick up the phone Monday morning at 8:30 and make phone calls. The controlling board meets on Monday, and I'm trying to find out exactly what time they meet. I believe they meet at 9, so if you call at 8:30, they're going to hear from you. The two House members, majority House members on the controlling board, are Representative Ron Amstutz, who has already expressed that he's not in favor of just giving the governor the authority to expand Medicaid. That he falls among those 38 members who believe that there are procedures and standards that you have to follow, including the Constitution of the state, in order to get these things done.
Yeah.
Now, is he someone who's, you know, strongly opposed to it? Maybe, maybe not. But he's just not, the procedure is the issue for him. Okay? So he is probably going to be a no vote. Representative, the other members, Representative Cliff Rosenberger. Now, he's from the Claremont County area. He's a new member. We're not sure where Cliff's going to be. I heard today from sources, and this is, we're taping this on Wednesday, heard today from sources that likely he would be a no vote. Now, interesting thing is both Amstutz and Cliff Rosenberger are vying to be the next House Speaker. Well, if you've got 38 members of your caucus saying no to this, which, if you vote yes, which one of you, if one votes no and one votes yes, who do you think is going to have the inside track of being House Speaker? Okay, so there's a little bit of politics at play even in that. It's also that one of the two of them is actually getting support from some of the insiders from the John Kasich administration, and it's not Representative Amstutz. And I'll say that. It's out there, okay? I'll say it. That doesn't mean that that influences the way this the gentleman votes, but it could play a part. We hope it doesn't. Problem is, he'll vote no, most likely, because if they've got the two Democrats, the member from the Office of Budget and Management and one of the two senators, they don't need his vote, so therefore he can vote no and leave it at that.
Yeah.
And we all know what that is. So, all we have to, basically the thing is call. I mean, if they get their phones blasted off the hook on Monday morning, the Democrats are not going to change. Sawyer and Redfern, don't waste your time. They're voting for this.
Yeah, this is
part of their boy's legacy. This is Barack Obama's legacy moment, and they're going to make sure that Ohio is right there to help it. Chris Widener is the key. So the Republican Senate member. He and probably Representative Rosenberger in the House. Call all four of them, though, because Amstutz and Coley need to hear from their
members. Yeah, they need to hear
too. All four of the Republican members need to hear from folks.
Yes.
And they need to hear loud and long and consistent from folks. But what it's probably going to get down to, Chuck, is the Kasich wouldn't have made this play unless he knew he had the votes.
Yeah.
Because it would be politically suicidal to do this if you didn't already know the outcome.
And let's be clear about this. John Kasich is running for president.
Well, he's not been too coy about that idea.
No.
Yeah, he's running for re-election for governor, but everything he's been putting out there has been based on national or federal issues. Okay, let's telegraph, shall we, Governor Kasich? You're running for president in 2016, and this is part of your framework.
Yeah.
I helped expand so that people could get insurance and they could get Medicaid. I get it. Okay? That's the reason why we're moving forward. But Chuck, it's in a way that he can say, no, I don't support Obamacare, but I'm expanding Obamacare in Ohio.
Well, okay, this is the same kind of failed strategy that gets Republicans to come in favor of things like immigration, quote-unquote reform.
Right.
The only thing that's reformed is the fact that the laws that were formerly keeping people from simply walking across the border and suddenly getting, you know, amnesty. This is the same kind of thing. He thinks this is going to buy him votes just the same way that George W. Bush thought that his immigration reform plan was going to buy him Hispanic votes. Not going to happen, folks. Why would anyone think that people would vote themselves a lower welfare check? Now, I'm not making the implication that Hispanics are all naturally on welfare. No. That's not people that come here and work and everything. Most of them have taken the time to get the green card. And the ones that haven't are very hardworking. But there are some who come here and do the anchor baby for benefits.
Yep.
There's a whole bunch of them. And they ship money back home, and they ship a lot of their welfare check back home. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, they're never going to vote for a Republican. Never. Unless that Republican comes out and does things like Medicaid expansion and supports Obamacare and votes for expansions of welfare benefits.
That's right.
It's an ugly game, and all it means is that you're going to pay more money because, let's face it, give me those numbers again. How much money is it going to require to give all the states that are looking to do Medicaid expansion? How much additional to the federal deficit is it going to be? And how much just came through on this deal that the Republicans are doing to fund the government and raise the debt ceiling? How much did they raise the debt ceiling? It's this...
At least $1 trillion temporarily.
Temporarily. Right. Only until the end of January.
Only until they can go and create another impasse so they can raise it again.
Yeah.
Ultimately, what they're going to do is they're going to step this across until they get to right before the summer break when they go out on the campaign trail. And that's when they're going to push for the rest of the enchilada. They're going to push for the other $5.3 or $4 trillion in debt increase so that they can get all the Obamacare the states lined up under Medicaid expansion to lock them into Obamacare.
Well, we're rapidly reaching the place where most people are takers rather than givers into the system.
Well.
And what happens when you do that?
Well, you run out of other people's money faster than you thought.
That's the famous Maggie Thatcher quote, socialism works until you run out of other people's money.
Yep.
We're about to reach a place when we're looking at $17 trillion in debt and adding another six, which is what Medicaid expansion, if all the states, not just Ohio, all the states take it, it's another $6 trillion. That doesn't count things like pension funds, of Social Security, Medicaid as the normal population ages. I'm 56 years old. I'm hoping to work forever because I frankly don't have the money to retire. And that's another thing, folks. Guard your retirement accounts, because one of the things the federal government wants to do is, in conjunction with Obamacare, is wants to seize control of your retirement account. Because it's a whole lot of money to grab. And the way they'll sell it to you is to say, we'll take care of it for you. We'll put it in a lockbox, to quote Al Gore when he was running for president. If you remember, put it in a lockbox. You remember that business?
Yep, yep.
Well, Social Security never was in a lockbox, and it's never designed to be in a lockbox. It's a Ponzi scheme. And you have to continue to seize more and more and more money to pay more and more and more benefits. And that's what this is all about. This is the seizure of more and more and more benefits, because, you know, we're up to what I'm trying to remember the numbers on the unfunded mandate at this point. I think it's over $100 trillion.
I'm not sure. I've not seen the numbers lately.
It's been a while. But folks, when those bills start coming due, we're bankrupt.
Yes.
There are currently about 150 million, maybe 155 million. Taxpayers in the United States of America. You start looking at numbers in the trillions and numbers in the hundreds of millions. That's a lot of money.
It is.
You know, if you know anything about exponents, it's 10 to the 6th versus 10 to the 9th. or 10th or 11th. If you're in 100 trillion range, you're now at 10 to the 11th power versus 10 to the 8th power. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is.
That's in the tens of thousands per taxpayer.
Yes, it is. It is not. It's not cheap.
So that's bankruptcy. And we're headed that direction. And this governor, who touts himself as a great a budget balancer, who has never really balanced, maybe at home, but a government budget, don't buy that stuff that John Kasich balanced the budget in the 90s. He put off the bills that we are now paying till now. This is now, we're getting close to 20 years later. Guess what? Those things are coming due. The bonds.
Yes.
And all that stuff. There was an article that ran on Drudge, and again, I didn't take the URL, but it talked about the fact that the Treasury just issued $8 trillion in bonds to pay $6 trillion in debt that they had to buy back.
Yes.
Pretty soon those numbers...
But they turned around and issued $8 trillion in new.
Yeah, exactly.
In other words, it's like levies at the local level. They just did a replacement levy.
Yeah, exactly.
They told you that your costs were going to be less, but they ended up being more.
And watch for this, because you're right, Barry, and it's interesting that you bring that levy thing up, because let's talk about that for a second. When contracts come due, school boards that don't have savvy members or are in the back pocket of the unions or are quote-unquote progressive will go into those negotiations knowing the money isn't there and saying, don't worry, we'll pass another levy. Then they come to you and say, if you don't pass this levy, your kid can't play football or you can't ride right. the bus or... we'll have to cut orchestra or music or art. That's the way this works. The teachers benefit, you pay, and you get manipulated into it every time by saying we have one of the greatest school districts in the state, and if we don't continue to spend this money on this, you're gonna find that we suddenly start falling, and next thing you know, we'll be like the Columbus School District. Folks, that's going to happen anyway because the model's broken. When you have people that are paying 2, 2.5, 3, 3.5, 4% of their assessed value every year to run a school district,
right?
The tail now wags the dog. And you have starting salaries in your school district that are in the $50,000 range. In Westerville, I think the starting salary here is $46,000 or $47,000 plus bennies. Man, I would have loved to have. Now, even
yes.
I came out of college in 1989 and didn't, adjusted for inflation, didn't make anything like this. And I had a science degree.
Yeah. And honestly, Charles, I'm not sure how it's sustainable because what you have is you're having these jobs at $40,000 to $70,000 a year, and they're being supported by people who are probably making minimum wage or that the average in the community is $10,000 to $15,000
less
than those wages.
And that's the bottom line here. And people are hoodwinked by this, oh, poor teachers. They're so underpaid. I got
kids, according to everybody, everybody's underpaid.
Yeah.
The point is that it is, we have free contracts in this country. This is the thing that gets under my skin, and I know we don't have time for this. But folks, you give your labor to someone, an employer, and you sign a contract saying that you're willing to do it for a certain rate. At that point, don't start crying about being underpaid. You're just a bad negotiator.
Yeah.
Now, the big problem is that the unions group negotiate. They're called collective bargaining. So therefore, many people who shouldn't be getting that wage gets it, and the ones who should be getting more are pulled down because of the laws of averaging.
Okay, as we go to the end, why don't you give the phone numbers?
Okay, well, I was afraid you were going to ask me that because I had just sent them over to you, but I happen to have them here. Senator Bill Coley is 61, these are all 614 area code, 466-8072. Senator Chris Widener, 466-3780. Representative Ron Amstutz, 466-1474. And Representative Cliff Rosenberger, 466-3506.
We'll put those up on the front of the website when we post this story. We are out of time. We ask that you would join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.